You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on today's Wisconsin Life, we'll learn about a Wisconsinite who is the first woman to win a Pulitzer Prize for drama.
First, a new report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism shows that despite strong public support, there have been no changes in gun background check laws in Wisconsin.
According to a Marquette Law School poll this year, 85% of registered voters in the state support closing what's called the background check loophole for private gun sellers. That number includes 84% who have guns in their homes. A CNN poll from June showed 90% of nationwide participants want expanded background checks.
Alexandra Arriaga joins us to talk about that new report. She's a reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Alex, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with our terminology. What is this background check loophole?
So the loophole, what that means is by federal law, licensed dealers are required to perform background checks for any firearm sales, and licensed dealers defined as anyone engaged in the business, and specifically excluding anyone who makes occasional sales or sales as a hobby. Basically the hobbyist sales are what we call private sellers who do not have to perform background checks.
And you start off your piece with the story of a Wisconsin woman who was killed when her estranged husband purchased an illegal gun. What happened?
So the woman, Zena Houghton, was granted a restraining order against her husband, Radcliffe Houghton, in 2012. And after feeling very threatened, and he went to this website, armless.com, and was able to purchase a semi-automatic handgun from a private seller. The next day, he went into her workplace at a salon and killed her and two other women and injured some others. And there's now a lawsuit from her daughter, who was at the salon at the time, against the website which facilitated that sale.
And in a lot of ways, this case you're talking about is a microcosm of the debate about these background check loopholes that we're talking about, because you also profile this woman's brother who is a supporter of a gun rights, a strong supporter, and yet he wants this loophole closed, and there is a strong public support for this. So where are we with laws in Wisconsin that would support this sort of change?
So Wisconsin does not expand on the federal requirements for background checks like 18 other states and D.C. have. There have been kind of proposals, kind of perennial proposals in the legislature specifically to expand background checks, but they've not even gained a hearing and haven't really gotten any traction.
Now, you checked in with gun policy experts because although there is strong public support for closing this loophole, there is debate about how effective it is. And who did you go to and what did they tell you about whether or not this policy would be effective to close this this loophole?
Some of the researchers that I spoke with, one has been doing this for 30 years, really nominate expanding on background checks as one of the top legislative strategies to reduce gun violence. One researcher from Johns Hopkins found that in Connecticut, when they expanded on background checks, the decade following, they had a 40% drop in firearm homicide rates. In contrast, he also studied Missouri's repeal of a similar law, which had a 23% increase in firearm homicide rates. And then you have other research, such as one from a University of Pittsburgh study, which kind of bolstered some gun rights arguments that criminals don't buy guns, they steal them. So they traced some firearms from police confiscated firearms and found that 79% of the perpetrators weren't legal owners.
And in terms of the requirements in place for private gun sellers, are there any, if not a background check, is there anything else that these private sellers are required to do?
So private sellers are not, they can legally sell make any firearm sale that they want as long as they don't have a reasonable cause to believe that the person they're selling to is prohibited. And so what some researchers and this former gang member that I interviewed have described this as don't ask, don't tell. So, Rico isn't going to bring up that he has a felony in his history and the person making the sale doesn't care to ask.
We're talking with Alexandra Arriaga right now, reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And she's joining us right now to talk about a new report on gun background checks in Wisconsin. And the National Rifle Association has been part of this dialogue. Tell us how they've responded to this question about expanding background checks.
So the NRA has the official stance of they're against this kind of legislation, calling it the criminalization of the private transfer of firearms, saying that it costs law-abiding gun owners time, money, and freedom. And then you have some NRA members, such as a shooting instructor that I spoke to and some firearms dealers who are either okay with background checks or strongly in favor. So there's kind of you see a division there.
And Wisconsin lawmakers, you mentioned before, this is not a move that has been able to pick up any sort of momentum in the legislature. What have lawmakers in Wisconsin have to say about this option?
So Democrats have introduced this bill a couple times. One, Senator Harris Dodd from Milwaukee, noticing a spike in firearm violence in 2015 in Milwaukee, brought it in the most recent session. And, you know, once again, it didn't receive a hearing. Republicans have mostly been uninterested in speaking on it. A statement from Walker that we got from his spokesperson told us Wisconsin already has gun background checks and didn't really address the private sale issue.
And so Governor Walker responded and said that Wisconsin already has background checks. Did you follow up and say, we're talking about this for private sellers and get a response to that?
We did, and with no response.
No response. You write about State Representative Therese Berceau, a Democrat from Madison, who did introduce a bill to close this background check loophole in the last legislative session. Tell us the story of that particular bill.
Basically, she's told me about how she was behind the bill when it came up in 2013 and again most recently, and how it's kind of been moved between committees and dying without hearings.
And now, we mentioned this story that we began with, the Wisconsin woman who was killed by her estranged husband, who had purchased an illegal firearm, didn't get a background check. This is now a pending lawsuit. What is the future of that lawsuit today?
I believe that the motion hearing is on November 1st.
And we'll leave it there. Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Alexandra Arriaga, reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She was with us talking about her new report, taking a look at gun background checks in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you're a woman between the ages of 50 and 74, you may be able to get mammograms less often. We'll find out about new guidelines on breast cancer screenings.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
The Pulitzer Prizes turn 100 this year. We're honoring the occasion with a look at five winners with Wisconsin ties. Writer Zona Gale's life in Portage inspired her work and won her national acclaim, including a Pulitzer Prize for drama, the first ever won by a woman. Gale's Portage home is now a museum, where I went to learn about Gale from local historian Judy Uhlberg.
I'm Judy Uhlberg. I have lived in the town of Portage, Wisconsin for 51 years. I came here to teach English, and people said, well, of course you know Zona Gale, and I had no clue. Well, Zona Gale was the only child of Charles Franklin and Eliza Beers Gale. In fact, her birthplace is two blocks over there. She started writing when she was very small, and her first book was on brown paper, and it was tied with a string. When she got to be a teenager, she started sending manuscripts away, and they came back and through the mail slot thumped. And finally, she did sell something, and she was so excited. I think the first time she sold it, she was at the university. She got on the train and came to Portage to show that, I think it was a $3 check, to her parents. And after college, she went, first of all, to Milwaukee, and she went to the newspaper, I think it was first the Evening Wisconsin, and knocked on the door and said, hello, I would like to write a story about this Tea Party or this, that, or another thing. And finally, they got so sick of her that they hired her. And then they gave her things that she was not accustomed to, robberies and murders and all that sort of thing. So she learned a lot. And then after a couple of years, she went to New York City because she was sending short stories and all that sort of stuff there. And so she thought it would be a lot easier if I did my reporting work there. And then by 1904, she doesn't have to be a reporter anymore. She can sell her short stories. She also had decided all the talk that she heard in New York was kind of the same kind of talk she'd hear in Portage. And so maybe because she wrote stories about the small town, maybe she should be closer to the source of her material. We are now in the study, which is very lovely. No telephone here, no typewriters. She wrote in longhand. She had a lady that typed it up and sent it to editors in New York. She was for women having the right to vote. She was against capital punishment, and she was also a pacifist. Little problem here. World War I comes along, and so she would not buy war bonds. Well, then her neighbors sent the government to investigate her. They thought she was a German sympathizer. And now all of a sudden she thinks, oh, maybe this wonderful small town isn't as wonderful. And that's when her really good writing starts. Well, I really like Birth. And she thought that was her best. That was the 1918. That was her first realistic novel in which the small town is not all that nice. Her novel, Miss Lulubette, was the best-selling novel in 1920, along with Sinclair Lewis's Main Street. And then somebody said, this should become a play. And so she made it a play. It didn't take her very long at all. She won a Pulitzer Prize for it. Well, we still teach Main Street in schools, but we don't teach Miss Lulubette. We in Portage, Wisconsin, know about Zona Gale, but that's about it. You know, she's like our star, for heaven's sakes.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Joining us now to tell us more about Zona Gale is Mark Seals, Associate Professor of English at UW-Baraboo Sauk County. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's an honor to talk to you.
Well, what first drew you to the work of Zona Gale?
Well, I'm an immigrant to Wisconsin. Moved here from Florida about 11 years ago. And one of my predecessors taught a course on Wisconsin literature. And when he was retiring, he wanted me to take over the course. And well, you can't teach a course in Wisconsin literature without focusing pretty closely on Zona Gale.
And you wrote the introduction to an upcoming edition of her novel, Miss Lulubette, and I'm so interested in that because I've never heard of this, and apparently this was a bestseller at the same time as one of Sinclair Lewis's books, and yet we haven't heard this name. So tell us a little bit what this novel is about.
Some critics called it a village comedy. It's really, you can see it as an early example of Wisconsin feminist literature, but it was a safe, comfortable kind of feminism, if you will, for the audience of the time who would have been put off by a more strident voice. It's the story of a spinster who lives with her sister's family in a town that's very much like Portage, like all of the towns that she wrote about. And she's treated pretty much like a servant. She's treated pretty much like a slave, actually. And it's the story of her coming to realize that she is a human being with rights and deserving of a life of her own.
Did a lot of her work flow directly out of what she saw in small town Wisconsin?
Yes, she was seen as one of the most important voices of small town America. Literary critic of earlier in the 20th century, Carl Van Doren, wrote about a movement that he called the Revolt from the Village, and she was seen as one of the most important leaders in the Revolt from the Village, the idea that small villages weren't these idyllic places where everyone was wonderful and cooperative. She wrote about the darker side, at least starting with the 1918 novel Birth.
And it sounds like Zona Gale was a trailblazer in a lot of ways, and she came back to the Portage area. How was she seen? What do we know about her personally?
Well, she was very dedicated to her parents. Her love for her parents and her dedication to them eventually ruined the one great love affair that she had when she was in her late 20s. Though she did marry in 1928 at the age of 54 to a woman she'd known, a man she'd known since childhood, William Breeze. She was a very articulate but very soft-spoken, gentle woman. And as a result, she was able, I think, to get a lot done because she won people over with her gentle nature.
Talking to Mark Seals, Associate Professor of English at UW-Baraboo Sauk County, looking at Zona Gale. She is a woman author from Wisconsin. I put out the woman part. She was the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for drama. Mark, as you were saying, she wrote sometimes about the downsides of life in a small town. We heard in the Wisconsin Life piece there about her neighbors suspicious of her for not buying war bonds during World War I. So she's writing things that might portray her town in a negative light. Were her neighbors and friends reading this stuff and maybe looking askance at what she was coming up with?
Well, actually, up until after World War I, the stories that she wrote were all set in a fictive version of Portage called Friendship Village, and they were very loving portraits. And so I think she was shocked when her neighbors turned against her for being a pacifist. And that's when the darker turn in her novels took place. That when she first published Birth, the New York Times review said, "Where, oh, where is the Zona Gale of Friendship Village?"
What do your students make of her writing? Does it hold up to reading?
My students like it very much. They're surprised. They want to compare it to more famous works of feminist literature like Kate Chopin's The Awakening, and they're surprised that they've never heard of it. My students from Portage all know who Zona Gale is, but I've still never yet had one who had read anything by her, and they're delighted to get a chance to read something by not just a Wisconsin writer, but a Wisconsin writer from right here.
Well, Mark, give us some homework, because I haven't read anything by her either. Where should I start?
I would actually start with Miss Lulu Bett. It's remarkable in that after it was published as a novel, it was a huge bestseller. Zona Gale and Miss Lulu Bett were household names. If you were to look at the online databases of newspapers, there were hundreds of references to Zona Gale in the New York Post alone in 1920 and 21. Every day had some mention of her and her work. And when she adapted it for a Broadway play, which actually debuted at Sing Sing Prison,
wow,
2 days after Christmas, she changed the ending dramatically. I won't give any spoilers, but it has a very different ending, and it wasn't popular with the crowds.
So
after only 9 or 10 performances, she changed it again. Mm. So the edition that's coming out in a few months will be the first edition ever to have the novel and both versions of the play.
Have you read or are you privy to all of the various endings to this play and book?
Yes, they're coming out in the new edition. And in fact, there was a 1921 film directed by William C. DeMille, Cecil B. DeMille's brother, which was from Paramount Pictures, which was very successful, and it had a fourth ending.
Well, Mark, has this play been put on in Portage or at your school?
It was put on in Portage several years ago, I believe, for one of the anniversaries. I don't remember which one. For some significant anniversary of Zona Gale, it was performed just a few years ago. And it's been performed in Milwaukee and 20 or 30 years ago. But it's not produced very much, which is surprising. It was the third play to win a Pulitzer Prize and the first by a woman.
And I want to follow up on something you said. You said this was premiered at Sing Sing Prison. Why was this book about mild feminism premiered at Sing Sing?
Actually, because the producer had helped to fund a performance stage at the prison to help give cultural outreach to the inmates, and the play they had been planning to debut fell through. So at the last minute, they said, "Well, let's give it a test showing at Sing Sing. And, right. the prisoners loved it.
So we have this Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, talk of the New York media for a long time, voice of small-town America. Why am I just hearing about her now? Why isn't she a household name still?
I think because she got a bit left behind by the shift in style in American literature. Though her works in the late teens and early 20s were seen as stripped down and bare writing without all the rhetorical flourishes of the late 19th century and early 20th century, when literature of Ernest Hemingway and that sort became the style, hers was seen, I think, as quaint. And I think it's possible that the success of her rhetoric, her propaganda, if you will, makes it so that it didn't seem as cutting edge. You know, women had the vote in 1920, the same year that Miss Lulabet came out. Women began to get increased opportunities in arts and in professional life. And so this, you know, quiet, gentle revolutionary, well, she succeeded.
So how big a deal was it in Portage and maybe beyond when she did become the first woman to win a Pulitzer Prize?
People were very excited. There's a letter that she wrote after the play ran for almost a year on Broadway. It then became, as many Broadway plays do, it went on tour, and it toured all up and down the East Coast and throughout the Midwest. And when it finally came to awfully close to Portage, not 10 miles away in Baraboo, she showed up and said that that was the true premiere of the play, and that the neighbors showed up just because she was a local girl made good, but that everybody left saying, "Wow, we were really surprised. We liked your play. We thought it was going to be highbrow."
So she had this love for Portage, and they loved her back. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Mark Seals, Associate Professor of English at UW-Baraboo Sauk County. And we've been talking about the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and playwright from Portage, Zona Gale.
That's G-A-L-E if you're looking to beat me to the library database to put that on hold. Coming up, some women may not need to get mammograms as often as they have in the past. We'll find out about some new guidelines. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Reveal. Tonight, the U.S. Department of Justice says it will reduce and eventually end its use of private prisons. In light of this, Reveal returns to an investigation of medical negligence in private prisons for non-citizens and the shift in immigration enforcement that gave rise to these prisons in the first place. That's coming up tonight at 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, advances in better breast imaging have led to a change in how often many women may need to get mammograms. While there are individual risk factors to take into account, it seems that many women who are past childbearing age can take the diagnostic test every 2 or 3 years. For some women, though, annual mammograms may still be important.
These new recommendations actually fit what UW Health has been advocating already. And here to talk about their approach is Dr. Elizabeth Burnside. She's on the faculty of the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health in the Department of Radiology. And she's also vice chair of health services and outcomes and a member of the UW Carbone Cancer Center. Dr. Burnside, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So before these new recommendations, what advice were women given about when to get mammograms?
So I think it's important to point out that this new study, which was published in a journal called the Annals of Internal Medicine, came out. It's a single data point. It's not actually a new guideline. So I think that it's important to emphasize that the guidelines themselves haven't changed. But I think before we talk about this new article and the guidelines, it's important for your listeners to know a little bit of background. So first of all, mammography is the best way to diagnose breast cancer early, and it saves lives in women over 40, but it's definitely not perfect. And I want to emphasize to your listeners that the trade-offs in mammography can be complex. So it's not perfect because there are false positives and false negatives. And this article points out that understanding these trade-offs is important, but we just have to be careful to understand it's not really changing what's recommended in terms of the guidelines.
So who is it who makes the ultimate recommendations?
Yeah, it's a great question. So as your listeners probably have heard on past shows, there are several guidelines out there, and they conflict, and it's very confusing. So there are a couple of several groups that make these guidelines, and in general, these groups do a systematic review of all the data that's out there. So some of these groups include the United States Preventive Services Task Force, which recommends screening with mammography every other year from age 50 to 74. But the American Cancer Society differs slightly by recommending annual screening mammography from 40 to 54. Other groups recommend annual screening from age 40 still. So these guidelines still conflict. This new article, though, uses modeling technologies to sort of help us get some insights into the trade-offs.
Well, let's talk about those trade-offs and what they might be. I mean, what would be the downside of a woman getting a mammography annually? It seems on the face of it, you check it out, you see whether or not there's anything worrisome there, and you have peace of mind. So what could go wrong?
Yeah, it's a great question. So mammography downsides are false positives. They come in sort of two flavors. One is a recall from your screening mammogram. So about 10% of women get a notification. They get a letter or a phone call letting them know they need more imaging. So that can be pretty anxiety-provoking. And then a small proportion of those women would go on to biopsy. And we call it a false positive because these women don't have breast cancers. There are also false negatives, so mammography failing to detect cancer when it's there. So those are the downsides. But the upside is that it's well established that there's a mortality reduction. So it saves lives from breast cancer. So one has to balance those benefits with those downsides.
And let's talk about this new study. The takeaway being from the study, it sounds like a large group of women may not, according to the study, need to get a mammography every year, need to get it annually. So what did it say?
Yeah, so before I tell you about the study, let me tell you about one other thing that's important to know to understand it in detail. So one characteristic on a mammogram is a woman's breast density. So breast density refers to the characteristics of the breast tissue seen on mammography. These characteristics are assessed by the radiologist when we interpret a mammogram, and it's recorded in every mammogram report. So some women have very dense tissue, and it looks white on the mammogram. Others have less of that dense tissue that looks white, and the mammogram looks more black or gray. So this breast density has been found to be a risk factor for breast cancer. There are other risk factors for breast cancer that we think about. For example, family history, age, race, whether a woman has had a prior breast biopsy, and others. So this article looked at all of those risk factors and using simulation modeling, which I'll tell you a little bit about, helped to understand what the trade-offs would be when screening at different frequencies, so every year, every other year, or every 3 years.
So looking at heightened risk of breast cancer and how dense the breast tissue is, so taking those groups of women there, how does that factor into what the study found about how effective a mammography might be or who could wait a little longer?
Right. So I think before we talk about the exact findings, let me tell you a little bit about these simulation models, too. So the simulation models that are used are designed to look at a population of women, and that population of women can be quite large, and it uses data from studies that have gone before. So the simulation models enable us to look at women with different risks and different breast densities. And what the study did find was that in women with high risk factors and high breast density, that annual screening mammography saved 15 to 20 breast cancer deaths per 1,000 women. So that's a lot. In women who had less dense breast tissue and were at lower risk, annual mammography saved less lives, 5 deaths, as compared to 3 deaths when women had mammography every 3 years. So those are a lot of numbers, but what the study said was that the trade-offs for women who had low breast density and low risk were different, less lives saved, but more false positives. Does that make sense?
I think so, and we'll dig into it a little bit more as we talk to Dr. Elizabeth Burnside from the W. Carbone Cancer Center, talking about a new study and what it could say about how often women should get mammograms. And as we're learning here, it's not women in general. It's specific categories of women, depending on how dense the breast tissue is and how high that risk of cancer might be. And so, Dr. Burnside, when you look at this compared to all of these organizations that call for annual screening, and if you're a woman who is concerned about screening for cancer yourself, if you hear that any deaths are saved from the mammography, what's the case then for maybe not doing it every year?
That's the crux of the matter. It's this trade-off between lives saved or breast cancer deaths avoided and false positives. So the authors of this study made a judgment that there was a certain sort of optimal threshold between these benefits, these lives saved, and these false positives. And that's sort of the challenge of this study. One thing that we know is more mammography, at least starting with annual mammography, will save lives, but it's offset by increasing false positives as you increase the frequency of mammography. So I think that's one of the sort of things that surprised me about this study, that there was a hard line drawn on the right threshold between these lives saved and false positives. And in general, we've been saying that there is no optimal threshold. It's hard to draw an optimal threshold, but in this study, that optimal threshold was sort of set.
We're talking now with Dr. Elizabeth Burnside from the W. Carbone Cancer Center, looking at a new study that calls into question how often women should get mammograms.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been getting a mammogram as often as is recommended by health policy, by your physician? If you fall into a lower risk group, would getting less frequent mammograms over time make you more likely to get them at all? Does getting them less often make you nervous? Are you confused by what you've heard in the media about guidelines on breast cancer screenings? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll be back with more of this conversation after a short break here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. We're continuing our discussion now about a new study looking at who needs to get mammograms and how often.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you gotten mammograms as often as your doctor has recommended? Why or why not? Are you confused by how guidelines have evolved over the last couple of decades? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. Dr. Elizabeth Burnside is with us from the Carbone Cancer Center.
And Dr. Burnside, this is your area of expertise. How do you make sense of this new study based on what you've seen and experienced and the women you've worked with?
I think what we try to emphasize at the UW is caring for patients using a team approach. So talking to women as they approach the age of 40 about their risk and about their values, understanding what's important to them, is a good place to start. Women, some get anxious with callbacks and with false positives. If we can help them understand that in advance, that can make things better. And some women highly value any small amount of mortality benefit that they might get by screening. So it's such an individual decision. That is really how we try to approach it. And you alluded to the way that UW manages their guidelines. We try to use that sort of patient-centered and very thoughtful approach when discussing screening mammography as women approach the age of 40.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Lori on the line in Crandon. Lori, hi.
Hi. Yes, I actually have a comment at the end of the session. So I'll start with my comment. When I hear that these studies are taking place, it makes me really nervous with the way insurance companies are now kind of dictating, you know, how many tests you have in a year. I'm referring to all different kinds of tests.
Lori, I'm going to jump in. We're having a tough time hearing you, but I think what you're getting at there is you're concerned that with a study like this, a woman who wants a mammogram every year, gives her peace of mind, might not have insurance coverage. The insurance might not pay for it. Is that going to be an issue here, Dr. Burnside?
I think that is a concern. One of the things that comes out of this study is, again, we realize that annual mammography saves the most lives but has the most false positives. If women know that and their value system is such that they want to reap that benefit, insurance hopefully will continue to cover that, the ability to have annual screening mammography. And importantly, the guidelines support that. The American Cancer Society supports the fact that women in their 40s should get screening, and then after 50, annual mammography should be an option. But I think that some of the guidelines and some of these articles, which pick a threshold and aren't sort of thinking about women's values, might have that effect, that insurance might not cover that. And I think that that definitely is something that's important for women to speak out about.
And we're getting a little short on time here. I want to make sure we get in another call. Molly, just briefly in Madison, you're next. Hi, Molly.
Hi. I'm just calling because I think I'd probably fall into one of the higher risk categories. And I, for one, have had a call back, but I sure don't feel like that would be a disincentive to me to have regular checkups. I mean, dealing with, you know, a couple hours of anxiety, it to me is much preferable than having something missed or becoming more advanced because you don't have the regular checkup.
Molly, thanks so much for that question. Molly's saying she's in a high-risk category. She doesn't mind the anxiety. To her, that's not a trade-off she's too concerned about. Well, what do you say to that, Dr. Burnside?
I think that she sounds like she's very informed, and talking to your doctor about your risk and about your values helps you understand them, and then it sounds like it's an experience that mammography is an experience that she feels is something that's warranted and comfortable for her.
And Dr. Burnside, just 30 seconds left here. Anything new that we should be looking for on the horizon when it comes to breast health?
You know, we do have new technologies that are starting to help us improve that balance of harms and benefits. At UW, we're doing digital breast tomosynthesis, which is a new technology that looks like in the early publications, which are getting to be quite high quality, it decreases false positives and increases cancer detection. So we hope that it will continue to see that that's a win-win.
Dr. Burnside, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Elizabeth Burnside. She's on faculty at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health in the Department of Radiology. And she's also Vice Chair of Health Services and Outcomes and a member of the UW Carbone Cancer Center.
Experts say expanding criminal background checks to include private gun sales could be the most effective way to reduce gun violence. 18 states plus the District of Columbia have done just that, closing the so-called gun show loophole. But as Bridget Bowden reports, attempts to expand background checks here in Wisconsin have faltered.
In 2012, Elvin Daniels' sister was killed in a mass shooting at a spa in Brookfield. The shooter, her estranged husband, was prevented from owning a firearm by a restraining order. Had he tried to buy a gun from a federally licensed dealer, he wouldn't have passed the required background check. Instead, he went online to a website called armslist.com.
And he bought the gun, paid with cash, without a background check. And then the next day, he walked into the salon and shot 7 people, killed 3, and then he took his own life.
Elvin was and is very familiar with firearms. He's a proud NRA member, a hunter, and enjoys target practice.
I was one of those that says, you know what, leave me and my guns alone. I still feel that, but I believe that everybody should go through a background check when they buy a gun.
Now, Elvin has become an activist. He's lobbied at the state and federal level for universal background checks. In 2014, he testified before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee.
You know, is one life, is it not worth it to go through a background check just to save one life? 10 lives? I mean, one is enough.
According to a recent Marquette Law School poll, 85% of registered voters in Wisconsin say they support background checks for all gun purchases, including unlicensed sellers. Ted Alcorn is the research director for Every Town for Gun Safety, which advocates for gun violence prevention. He says universal background checks are the top legislative strategy to prevent gun violence.
We already have a background check system that we've invested a lot of effort in creating. Why wouldn't we require a person who's buying a gun from an unlicensed seller to uphold the same public safety requirements that we require when they buy a gun from a licensed dealer?
And he says the statistics show they do reduce gun violence.
In the 18 states now that require background checks for all gun sales, we see much lower rates of gun violence than in those states that do not require background checks for all gun sales.
But Republicans who control state government have blocked attempts to require background checks on guns purchased from private sellers. Bills introduced by Democrats to enact universal background checks in recent sessions have died without a hearing. Retired police officer Kurt LaHaye runs a shooting range in Deerfield. He teaches self-defense and NRA-sponsored firearm courses. He says he buys his guns from licensed dealers, mostly because he usually gets a better deal that way.
So anytime that I purchase a firearm, I fill out two forms, one for the state, one for the federal government, and they do a background check.
He says he wouldn't have a problem with requiring background checks for private sales, as long as the requirements didn't go beyond what's already required from licensed dealers. But he's skeptical that it would do anything to reduce gun violence.
They're going to acquire them regardless of laws, because they're criminals. They don't recognize laws.
The National Rifle Association is staunchly against laws that would require universal background checks. In an email to the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, NRA spokesperson Catherine Mortensen said these laws, quote, criminalize the commonplace practices of law-abiding gun owners, saying they cost gun owners time, money, and freedom. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.